This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield approval. If you qualify and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is On Point. If President Trump has been consistent about anything, it's trade. About how our trading partners, as he sees it, are running rings around us. In office, he's been slapping tariffs on friend and foe, mostly friend. Latest case, NATO ally, Turkey. Which brings us to the WTO, the World Trade Organization. That's where trade fights go to get settled. And there's talk and worry that this administration is picking so many trade fights, the WTO may fall apart. This hour on Point, Trump, trade, and the WTO. You can join us on air or online. Are you following the tariffs just slapped on Turkey? Do you know why we've slapped tariffs on Turkey? Are you with the Trump administration on all these trade wars? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Before we dig into the WTO and the Trump administration, let's go to Turkey, where there's a lot more than just the tariff story going on. Joining me now from Istanbul via Skype is Piotr Zalewski. He's the correspondent there for The Economist. He's just filed a new story today, which you can find on our website, onpointradio.org. Piotr, thanks for joining us on Point.
Hi, and thanks for having me.
What is the latest you can tell us from Turkey?
Well, the latest is that today has not been as bad a day, as terrible a day as the past week or two. The lira has actually strengthened against the dollar by about 5% on the day, last time I checked. And I think that's a result of some of the, you know, more or less reassuring noises that the Turkish government has made about containing or at least limiting the currency collapse here. Refresh our memory, the lira has now lost about 40% of its value against the dollar since the start of the year, and 25% since the U.S. Imposed sanctions against two Turkish ministers 2 weeks ago. And even that was before Donald Trump imposed or doubled tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from Turkey.
Piotr, there is an expression, all politics are local. The president of Turkey and his control of the economy and his refusal previously to raise interest rates to deal with inflation. How much infighting is there in Turkey about those topics?
Not much, really. I think the government's constituency and much of the opposition has squarely lined up behind Erdogan. So has the media, which is also in his grip, or in the grip of conglomerates that are beholden to him. And so there hasn't really been that much of a debate. I think Erdogan has made a point of saying that the only person or the only power to blame for the current currency crisis is the U.S. and Donald Trump. And that's obviously false, as this was, this is a crisis largely of Turkey's making, largely of Erdogan's making. But I don't think that's something that Turkish audiences will hear very often. Obviously not from Erdogan, but they will not hear from their own media either.
Let's hear from the Turkish president, who took aim at the United States this morning, calling for a retaliatory boycott of U.S. electronics. Here from Reuters news agency is what the Turkish president said via an interpreter.
We will produce every product we are importing from abroad with foreign currency here, and we will be the ones exporting these products. We will impose a boycott on U.S. electronics products. If they have iPhones, there is Samsung on the other side.
Piotr, did the tariffs that the United States announced on Friday for Turkish officials, did that come from out of the blue, or was there some sense that this is a whole new ballgame under this Trump administration as far as tariffs are concerned, and the relationship with Turkey has not been good of late, and they would be hit by new tariffs?
Well, it seemed like Turkish officials were blindsided by the nature of these sanctions. I think the expectation here is that sanctions, some kind of U.S. sanctions, have become inevitable. But I'm not sure anyone predicted that Trump would resort to doubling tariffs. The initial sanctions that the U.S. Treasury imposed against Turkey were sanctions against two Turkish ministers. These took the form of an asset freeze, and these were directly related to the arrest and continued detention of an American preacher, Andrew Brunson, who has now been in a Turkish jail for nearly 2 years. That said, I mean, I think, there is still expectation, there's still anxiety about future sanctions, but with the tariff decision, I think there's no longer any certainty as to what shape these sanctions might take.
There are breaking news stories, Reuters is reporting that the Turkish airline and also their telecoms firm will be halting U.S. advertising in the U.S. media in response to the crisis and the relations between the two allies, the United States and Turkey. Also, regarding the pastor that you mentioned, the top U.S. diplomat in Turkey has called for the cases against that American pastor, Andrew Brunson, and others who are being held in Turkey, other Americans, to be resolved, quote, without delay and fair and transparent manner. How much of this, from your vantage point, is about trade and economics and tariffs, and how much of this is about you have our people, you need to let them go?
I think it's mostly about the latter, and it's about a range of other conflicts between Turkey and the U.S. From what I'm hearing, there is a sense of exasperation in Washington about, obviously, the detention and continued arrest, or the arrest and continued detention of the pastor, about the Turkish purchase of a missile defense system from Russia, about the conflict between Turkey and America in Syria, where Turkey has tried to fight Kurdish insurgents that are America's top ally on the ground. And all of that, I think, is feeding into the current dispute. And that's, largely what the sanctions seem to be related to.
For us non-economists, can you flesh out why the financial troubles of Turkey, obviously an important country in that region, what importance it has as far as a ripple effect throughout Europe, and why an American sitting at home listening to this should be concerned about what's transpiring in Turkey?
Well, there is some risk of contagion. Turkish or other European banks who might be dangerously exposed to the situation in Turkey, and the ability of Turkish banks to roll over loans. But, for the time being, I think the biggest problem in Turkey is the extent to which Turkish companies have been exposed to the falling lira. These are companies that have racked up somewhere in the area of $220 billion in foreign currency loans over the past 2 years. And many of those loans are coming due. And if you're a Turkish company that has revenues in lira, but debts in dollars, well, your debt burden has almost doubled over the past year or so. And so these companies are now lining up to have some of their debts refinanced by the Turkish banks. And that's obviously putting or starting to put a major strain on the banking sector here. And it's quite conceivable that, you know, with the lira falling, or even with the lira remaining at where it is today, which is about 6.5, at least some Turkish companies will default.
I'm speaking to Pyotr Zalewski. He's the Turkey correspondent for The Economist, and he is talking to us from Istanbul. Pyotr, I recall in the 2008 financial crisis here, it was almost a day-by-day proposition. What's happening as far as the market today? What's happening as far as the market tomorrow? How are people on the ground looking at this right now? Is there a big picture view of where you think this is going in the next week, month? Or is it, we had a good day yesterday, we're hoping to have a good day today?
Well, we had a decent day today, but that's only, you know, relative to the horrors that the Turkish lira has had to endure over the past few weeks. And it does feel quite day to day, especially as, you know, this is something that is this seems largely to be in the hands of two rather unpredictable leaders. And that's, you know, Donald Trump on one side and Recep Tayyip Erdogan on the other. You know, remarkably, Recep Tayyip Erdogan has not relented. He does not appear to be making any concessions, neither to economic reality nor to the Americans. You know, it's clear that resolving this crisis begins with releasing Pastor Brunson and sending him home, and Turkey appears to be signaling that it's not going to do so. On and down the line, you know, there are reforms that Turkey needs to implement. There's action that the central bank here needs to take for this problem to go away, and so far the government has shown no willingness whatsoever to take the steps that are necessary.
It is a subject that is obviously the most important subject in the country of Turkey, but the ripple effects could be great as the stock market has reacted. Pyotr Zalewski is the Turkey correspondent for The Economist. He spoke to us from Istanbul. Pyotr, thank you so much for joining us on Point.
And thank you for having me on.
When we come back, we talk with a former American trade representative about the administration's trade policies. You can join the conversation. Do you think something positive will come out of all these trade battles? Do you worry we're picking too many fights for the wrong reasons? I'm Bud Mishkin. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. States, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're back with a brand new season.
We've got Erykah Badu, Lenny Kravitz, Black Thought, and more.
You'll hear B-side stories from A-list guests. Subscribe now.
This is On Point. I'm Bud Mishkin. The Trump administration has slapped new tariffs on Turkey, just as that country's economy is ready to slip into freefall. And we want to talk about trade wars, how they're fought and resolved, and how President Trump is fighting them now. You can join the conversation. Do you believe the deck is stacked against the U.S. in our trade deals, NAFTA, for example, as its critics have argued? What do you know? What do you want to know about what the WTO has to do with all of this? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Ambassador Jennifer Hillman. Today, she's a professor at the Georgetown University Law Center. She was a trade negotiator with the Office of the United States Trade Representatives in the Clinton administration, as well as general counsel there. She also worked for the World Trade Organization itself as one of seven members from around the world on the WTO's final court of appeals, the appellate body. Ambassador Hillman, thanks for joining us on Point.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So can you give us a brief history lesson and also an understanding of the World Trade Organization? I realize this is something we could spend hours on. And why it pertains to daily life in the United States today, what importance it has in the lives of everyday Americans.
Sure. So the WTO grew out of an older organization referred to as the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade that was created in 1947 at the same time that the United Nations and the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and a number of those institutions that sort of set up the system governing international economic relations were set up. And then it was transformed in 1995 from the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade into a full-blown international organization, the World Trade Organization. It's headquartered in Geneva, Switzerland, and currently has 164 countries as members of the WTO.
Now, you've served for an American administration, the Clinton administration. You've also worked for the World Trade Organization. We hear a lot now about the criticisms from the Trump administration about the WTO. In the short history of this organization and the United States' relationship to it, have there always been complaints about it, or is this something of more recent ilk?
Well, there have always been some concerns about some of the individual decisions that are made in particular disputes. But I think by and large, both the United States and most of the other members of the WTO see tremendous value in the WTO. First and foremost, because it sets a set of clear rules that everybody is supposed to trade by and moves us away from the kind of chaotic and to some degree sort of power politics, power-based trading system that the United States seems to be wanting to push, at least the Trump administration seems to be wanting to push back towards.
Does this come, Ambassador, does it all come under the heading of we've seen other institutions that are part of the post-World War II world, and we've seen the administration push back against some of those, and this now joins the list?
I would say yes. There's a fair amount of sense that the Trump administration is just, as a general matter, not very predisposed towards multilateral institutions and multilateral rules that they believe, I think, constrain in some way the United States's exercise of what it sees as its own power, its own sovereign right to engage in behavior that's perhaps outside of the norm and outside of the rules-based world.
Before we get back to the president and his criticisms of the WTO and what may transpire because of that, can you give me an example from your time at the WTO of a particular conflict that came before you, be it rather simple or be it complex, although I got to imagine if anything came before the WTO, it was pretty complex, and how it was resolved?
Well, again, the disputes range from very large disputes covering things like subsidies for Airbus or Boeing that are governing billions of dollars in trade down to very minor in terms of trade volume disputes, but that are very significant. Just to give you one tiny little example, I sat on a case that was involved in a dispute between New Zealand and Australia over trade in apples. And as many people know, New Zealand is a significant producer of apples, but they had been banned going into the Australian market because the apples in New Zealand, the apple trees in New Zealand had various bugs or fungus or other diseases that Australia did not want to enter into the Australian market or affect Australian apple trees. But the argument then came down to, okay, New Zealand accepts that they have this bug and this fungus, but their point was that those bugs and funguses live on trees, and what they're trading is apples. So the dispute came around this issue of can you show whether or not the bug or the fungus moves on an apple when it's traded between New Zealand and Australia and moves in a way that it could actually affect and impact the orchards for apples in Australia. And at the end of the day, our decision was no, that these things cannot move on the apples. They stay on the trees. And therefore, Australia had no basis to keep its ban on apples coming from New Zealand. And so Australia was asked at the end of this dispute to lift this ban because there was no scientific basis for it to keep it. So an example of a small dispute, but again, a similar kinds of disputes are happening all the time where U.S. agriculture producers are seeking access into markets where our goods have been banned for reasons that are not based on science. And so we have been using these exact same WTO rules to open up markets for our agriculture exports that are going into many places around the world.
A small dispute, but for the people involved, not small by any stretch
exactly.
of the imagination. The online journal Axios reported at the end of June that President Trump has been thinking about pulling the U.S. out of the WTO, something the White House later denied. Here's what the president had to say to reporters days later.
WTO treated the United States very badly, and I hope they change their ways. They have been treating us very badly for many, many years, and that's why we were at a big disadvantage with the WTO. And we're not planning anything now, but if they don't treat us properly, we will be doing something.
Ambassador, how much of this do you see as simply, or not simply, but a part of this is a difference in philosophy? In other words, organizations like the WTO, the UN, NATO, to name a few, take a very long view of history and their work. And this administration, and certainly the president, for want of a better term, is a short-term guy. It's all about the deal, as in the book he wrote or the book he's connected to, The Art of the Deal. Are we looking at differences in philosophies here?
I think it's a little hard to say. Certainly, the president has indicated that his preference is to do everything in a bilateral way. I mean, to do all deals as between the United States and one other country. And the WTO, given that it's 164 countries, is obviously not a bilateral organization, and it does its agreements in a multilateral way. But when you step back from it and say, you know, how has the WTO, in essence, wronged the United States? I think there, in my own view, the president is just simply wrong. If we look at what's happened in the cases that have been brought by countries at the WTO's dispute settlement system, the United States has brought and won more cases than any other country at the WTO. So we have been a major user to try to make those rules work to the advantage of U.S. companies, U.S. farmers, U.S. exports, and we've been the biggest winner at the WTO. So part of it is I think there has to be a little bit of a look at what's actually happened. And the second thing is to think about how is it that the WTO interacts. And mostly it is to set a very basic set of rules that are around certain disciplines, starting with the fact that you cannot discriminate against countries on the basis of their nationality. In other words, you cannot treat goods coming in from the European Union because we're now saying maybe the EU is a foe in some way. You cannot all of a sudden start treating goods from the EU differently than you treat goods from Brazil or Argentina or Japan. You have to abide by basic disciplines that you will not discriminate on the basis of nationality, that you will not charge tariffs that are above the level of tariff that you've agreed upon in negotiations with all of your trading partners.
Ambassador, let's take some phone calls. People are lining up to talk about trade and the WTO. Andy is calling from Middlebury, Vermont. Andy, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. When the first tariffs went into place, there's an article, I'm afraid I can't give it proper attribution right now, saying that Canada should just start making generic versions of our drugs, that the WTO is responsible for our patents and our trademarks having international teeth, and that if we're not going to abide by these rules, that other countries could come after our intellectual property. I'm wondering if that's the case.
The answer is, by and large, to some degree, yes. What the WTO has is an agreement, trade in intellectual property, TRIPS, as part of its agreement. That TRIPS agreement, again, contains rules that now make adherence to those intellectual property disciplines part of the WTO system, so now applicable to all 164 members, whereas it used to be the case that individual treaties governing patents, etc., had some members but not all. Now all of the rules on intellectual property that are governed by that TRIPS agreement apply to all of the members of the WTO. So it gives us much better rights for those that hold patents or copyrights or trademarks in the United States, the ability to use the WTO as a way of enforcing their intellectual property rights against countries like China and others that are consistently engaging in the theft of our intellectual property.
At this point, we'd like to bring in another voice. Phil Levy is Senior Fellow on the Global Economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He's formerly a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and from 2003 to 2006, he served as a senior economist for trade for President Bush's Council of Economic Advisors, and then as a member of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's policy planning staff covering international economic affairs. Phil, thank you for joining us on Point.
It's good to be with you.
So from that experience, working for the Bush administration, the second President Bush, involved in international economics and also on the staff of Secretary of State Rice, what do you see transpiring right now as far as the World Trade Organization and the Trump administration?
Oh, I think I agree with almost all, as I usually do, with what Ambassador Hillman said. I think the one twist I would add to what's happening is there's a consistent pattern that much of President Trump's philosophy on trade seems to come from the steel industry, that he's got an awful lot of advisors with steel connections. And as I'm sure Ambassador Hillman could detail, if you want to look at where there's any evidence of the WTO deciding repeatedly against the United States, it tends to be where we have twisted some rules on steel. So I think that's kind of the hidden explanation that's behind this. But broad brush, I completely agree. It's an aversion to multilateral rules and to anything that sort of constrains U.S. freedom of action. And it's something that would be very damaging to the U.S. in the long run.
Can you explain to us a bit further, again, for us non-economists, why the stress on steel, why that would be a problem? Other elements of that would be a problem?
Sure. Well, I think one of the things that's happened is we agreed on some rules at the WTO which said, you can offer protection for industries to let the government put on tariffs under very particular circumstances. We've done that really vigorously in the steel sector, and there have been numerous cases at the WTO about whether the U.S. has overreached in this, whether it has abused those rules. And WTO disputes, this is something called zeroing, but that's probably more arcane than you want to get into. but it's basically how do you take an average badly. And the WTO has said the U.S. is taking its averages badly. The U.S. keeps tweaking its procedure and coming back and getting ruled against. So I think this has been, for example, a persistent complaint of Robert Lighthizer, who is the U.S. trade representative. So I think that's where a lot of this is coming from. So when you hear the president, as he said in your clip, we're getting treated very, very badly, there's remarkably little evidence for this. I mean, for the most part, the U.S. does quite well when it's pressing complaints against other countries. So if you're wondering where that's coming from, it's there. That doesn't help most Americans, but it does help the steel sector.
You mentioned
And then if I could add just a tiny point on steel, if you think about it, what the president has now done is to impose this 25% tariff on imports of steel from almost the entire world, except now it's made the tariff 50% just for Turkey. And yet it's not imposed the tariff on Argentina, Brazil, Korea, and Australia. When you look at that from a WTO perspective, that is automatically violating a number of the core principles of the WTO. One of the principal rules is that, again, you may not discriminate against countries, and yet we're imposing the tariffs on some but not all. So we're clearly discriminating in violation of the WTO. The second basic principle of the WTO is that you cannot charge a tariff that exceeds the amount that you agreed upon in the course of a tariff negotiation to set set your tariff at. And the United States, over the course of these agreements, agreed to set its tariff on steel at 0% duty. So anything above 0% is a breaking of that commitment by the United States. So this 25% tariff is a clear violation of the WTO rules. And part of, I think, what the Trump administration is reacting to is they do not want to be challenged on these tariffs on steel and aluminum, even though they are a clear violation.
I should note that we did put out a lot of calls yesterday to find someone to represent the administration's view on world trade. We called and researched several conservative research institutions, such as the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, and more. True, it's the summer, summertime doldrums. People are traveling. But the fact of the matter was that a few economists in Republican circles seemed to agree with this administration's trade policies. And that's not a surprise to the administration. And they don't really seem to be bothered by that. You mentioned the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer testifying. He testified before a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee last month. Things got a bit heated. Here's an exchange with Democratic Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii. Schatz said when it comes to trade policy, the Trump administration, quote, is playing a game of chicken with China. Schatz said a state-run economy like China's can play the long game better than a democracy can. Quote, why would you stare down a non-democracy, he asked. And Lighthizer fired back. Here's some of the exchange.
We're a democracy, and so we take a shorter-term view because we are responsible to our voters periodically.
So does that mean that democracies always lose to authoritarian governments? Does that mean the state capital?
No, it just
does that mean.
Sir, it just means you don't pick stupid fights.
Phil, would you like to jump in on that? About 20 seconds before we go to a break. The back and forth, an example of how passionate this subject can be.
Absolutely passionate. There's a complete agreement that there's some issues with China. It's just, do you pick stupid fights or do you do this intelligently?
We're talking about the Trump administration and the WTO and its effect on you, whether the president's myriad trade disputes may break the WTO and whether we should worry about that. You can join the conversation. Is this post-World War II system of trade deals out of date and in need of an overhaul? Again, and what is its tangible effect on you? I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
So you just woke up and you want to find out about the latest news. That is when you turn to Up First, the 10-minute news podcast from NPR News. Here, Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Bud Mishkin. We're talking about the World Trade Organization, about world trade, and about the way the administration's trade officials are waging its many trade wars. You can join the conversation. Do you think the administration is right to want to shake up the rules of global trade? Do you think they're too radical? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our guests, Ambassador Jennifer Hillman, a former trade negotiator in the Clinton administration, as well as at the World Trade Organization itself, and Phil Levy, a former economic advisor in the George W. Bush administration. He's now a senior fellow on the global economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Many people chiming in, listeners chiming in on Facebook and Twitter. For example, Ed75 writes, severe sanctions are really an act of war. Let's hope it doesn't escalate or that the Turkish leader lets this man go. And Steph writes, Turkey is just one of several countries with a common problem. They borrowed heavily when the dollar was cheap. Now that it's strengthened, they, quote, and Steph uses quotes here, face soaring debt payments they may no longer be able to make. To your phone calls we go. David is calling us from Woodbury, Connecticut. David, thanks for joining On Point.
Oh, thank you. Hi, bud, everybody. These trade sanctions are simply a wrecking ball to the world order. It's an outrage. Cars and trucks are more expensive here. And of course, China's hitting us back. And now so farmers can't pay can't sell their crop to them. And it's just simply an outrage.
David, thank you for your call. Let's move on to some more callers. We have plenty of them. John is also calling from Connecticut, Cromwell, Connecticut. John, you're on Point.
Oh, I just want to say, you know, the pastor that they put in jail was a pastor of about 50 and a Baptist pastor. And then they say in Turkey they want to exchange him for a guy named Gulen, which they want to basically probably kill him because he was the person that controlled the country before. So they're trying to extort us with an American citizen that had a pastor church of about 50. Aside from that, there's thousands of people in jail in Turkey for opposing this leader. This is not no democracy. It resembles nothing of the West, and I don't even know why we have him as a NATO ally. He should not be a NATO ally because he's nothing like us.
I don't think anyone has mistaken, shall we say, what's going on in Turkey now for a democracy. I think people understand that it's an authoritarian regime. Another phone call now, as we say with the calls. Ali is calling from Boston. Ali?
Hi, thank you for taking my call, Bud. I wanted to ask your guest a question regarding currency manipulation, a major issue in previous administration with, if I recall correctly, with China mainly, was the fact that they artificially keep their currency low, hence continue growth on export section. Is there any provision in the WTO regarding currency manipulation, whether directly through the central banks or indirectly through subsidization to the industry?
Ambassador, I'm going to direct that to you, if you would.
Yes, the answer is there is a connection. It does, however, require that there be a finding by the International Monetary Fund. So it requires a coordination with the IMF in terms of whether or not a country is engaging in currency manipulation. And the difficulty always is that you have to also show that the currency is being manipulated in order to gain a trade advantage. And to date, this provision has never actually been used because the IMF has been reluctant to make that particular finding that a country is manipulating its currency in order to gain a trade advantage. Because of this unwillingness or inability to coordinate between the WTO and the IMF on these findings, there has been some new language being developed in and around, for example, what used to be referred to as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, to try to create some newer ways of thinking about how do we link currency manipulation with trade policy.
Phil, I'm going to address this to you. As I was doing some reading for this segment and lots of research, it struck me that perhaps what we're looking at, and this might be a bit of a stretch, is that in the sports world, especially in the NFL, the irony of the NFL has been through the years that the people who own the teams, these people who have done quite well in capitalism, at least started the NFL when it really gained ground in the 1960s with kind of a socialist, shall we say, or sharing of wealth, of TV money wealth. And that's how a team from Green Bay could coexist with a team from New York or Boston or Los Angeles. But through the years, individuals from some of the biggest teams, Jerry Jones of the Dallas Cowboys come to mind, wanted to do their own individual deals, as in, why do I need to be part of since we're so popular, why can't I do my own deal? Are we dealing with any of that here in terms of the current administration looking at deals that involve so many countries, much smaller countries, and the viewpoint from Washington now is, why do we have to be part of that? We could just do our own better one-to-one deals.
Well, first, as a lifelong Packers fan, I like the premise, but I'm not sure it actually applies to the WTO situation. It's worth remembering that as the WTO was developed, and Ambassador Hillman gave you the history where this started as the GATT, it was predominantly a small number of major countries, the EU kind of functioned as a country doing this, who were getting together and setting rules that were mutually beneficial. It was not the same kind of socialist, let's try for competitive balance. there have been recent attempts to sort of maybe tilt things a little bit more or take into account the needs of developing countries. But one of the big issues you have at the WTO is it doesn't cover everything Americans think it covers. So when you see a country like China apply subsidies, we say, those subsidies must be wrong. That's cheating. That's not, you know, free and fair trade. The trick is the WTO does not ban all subsidies, and it's exactly for the reason that many of these major players, like the United States over the years, have said, you know, we have some subsidies that we enjoy doing, and we're going to keep the rules such that they work for us. So I don't think it's actually that we made these mistakes earlier. I'm not sure the president's always fully aware of what the rules were. I think it may have been a very much narrower focus that he has on certain key sectors that have been subject to disciplines like steel.
Let's go back to your phone calls now. Stephen is calling from Milford, Massachusetts. Stephen, thanks for joining us on Point.
Hi, Bud. I was just curious. You know, we constantly hear about the tariffs that the U.S. is imposing on these other countries, but we very seldom hear what the other countries are imposing on us. And I'd just like some input on why, you know, you can't take a generic view of the whole world and say, you know, we're going to impose this much tariffs on certain countries. But there are countries that are taking advantage of us. And why can't we retaliate in some way, you know, apples to apples? If they're imposing tariffs on some of our products, why is it wrong for us to do the same?
Stephen, which, so stay with us for a second, which, do you have an example that you can cite?
No, but I mean, I don't have examples, but I mean, if you listen to the news, it's constantly harping on these 25%, say, steel tariffs that the U.S. is imposing on these other countries. Well, what are these other countries doing to us? In the case of Canada, we heard a little bit about their milk tariffs on us, and you know, obviously it was like 300% or something, but you know, we don't hear much about what China's doing to our markets as much as what we're doing to them.
Actually, I think when it comes to China, more and more of us are paying attention and do hear about what's going on with China. Ambassador Phil, would you like to jump in on that?
Sure. I'll give you just as an example. I mean, part of it is the tariffs fall into what I would think of as two categories. One is what's the normal, usual tariff. And again, if you look at the numbers, the United States has relatively low tariffs, but there are certainly many countries that have even lower. So, for example, the trade-weighted average tariff in the United States, the normal tariff, I don't mean these special ones on steel or aluminum or on China, the trade-weighted average in the United States is 1.6%. But the trade weighted average in other countries is even lower. In Canada, it's 0.8%. In Switzerland, it's zero. In China, it's 3.5%. In Brazil, it's 8%. So countries have a range of tariffs, but they're not wildly different from this general notion of a relatively low amount of tariffs that are being applied. And that's exactly why the WTO was created, was to negotiate down tariffs across the board. The tariffs that we're talking about more recently are very special because they are of tariffs that the United States has chosen to apply on steel and on aluminum and on China. And everyone in the world has reacted to those tariffs because they are fundamentally illegal under the WTO rules. And so I think the perception by many of our trading partners has been, if you, the United States, are going to start by breaking the rules, we must respond. And their response has been to impose tariffs on United States' products that are equivalent in amount to the tariffs that the United States has put on steel and aluminum and on China.
We go back to your phone calls now. Robert is calling from Southborough, Mass. Robert, thanks for joining us on Point.
Hello, Bud. I've been a researcher for 25 years on the global apparel industry and labor problems in it, and I have a very different perspective on the WTO than your two guests. And I think they understate the amount of discontent with the WTO among working people here and elsewhere. For example, there is no guarantee of labor rights in the WTO rules, whereas there are guarantees to investors that protect their stakes in property. There is not a symmetry there. Further, the WTO has a dispute settlement process which is secretive, which is done by lawyers, not judges, and which is not open to public scrutiny or challenge. So you misstate, I think, the flaws in that system, and the president is taking advantage of this discontent, I think poorly and wrongly, but nevertheless, it's there, and it is the seed of the disgruntled support that he gets.
Thank you, Robert. Let's give our guests a chance to respond. Phil?
Yeah, well, Ambassador Hillman might be better on the things with the dispute settlement mechanism. It is true that you have some things that are covered and some things that aren't. We have, the U.S. has been eager to keep its own approaches to labor rights, so you have some dealings with this, but relatively little. Actually, there's limited stuff in the WTO on investor rights. We've done more on that on our regional agreements. These agreements are whatever the participating countries choose to make them. It's probably wrong to think of the WTO as this separate sovereign power. It's really a place where people come together and they strike mutually beneficial trade deals. So that's what you see is what has emerged from that. I don't think that that is the core problem that many people perceive in terms of destroying, say, American manufacturing.
Let's go back to the...
On the WTO dispute settlement side, I'll only say that there has been a lot of work recently to make sure that the process is more open and accessible to everyone. So both the panel hearings and the appellate body hearings are often opened to the public. Most of the major countries are now putting all of their briefs and everything that they're arguing about on the public record. So I would agree that it started out as a more closed process. But over the years, the dispute settlement system itself has been much more opened up. Perhaps it still has quite a long way to go in becoming completely open. But there is obviously an ability to challenge the decisions of the panel. That's the whole point of having an appellate body and an appellate review process, which was a new development in the dispute settlement system, so that there is now the ability for governments to challenge a panel if they think the panel has gotten it wrong.
Let's try and get a call or two in before the end of this segment. Gavin is calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. Gavin, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thank you, bud. Hey, I'm just calling today just with a question about, as the U.S. is starting to retreat out of the world trading system and starting to renege on its different alliances and different treaties that it's had trading-wise with these different partners, who or what nation or what nations start to really fill into the U.S.'s vacuum, especially in light of the U.S. pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations and throwing the EU in negative light and threatening NAFTA? You know, what nations do you see really stepping into this vacuum, and is it already starting to take form as to what nations are going to be the winners out of this? And thank you for taking my call.
It's a good question, Gavin. Phil?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think there's no nation that is, you know, perfectly equipped to do that. What we have seen is the European Union has been actively striking trade deals with Canada, with Japan, with others, stepping into that void a little bit. China has been trying to. So when the U.S. backed away from the TPP, this opened the door more for this regional comprehensive economic partnership that China has been pushing. That's not a perfect substitute, and I think some of the countries in the region have a bit of leeriness about China's role. But this is part of the danger when the U.S. pulls back, is that these negotiations go on and rules get set. We're just not at the table.
The other one that I would add is Japan, which really did lead the effort to go ahead and implement the Trans-Pacific Partnership without the United States. So Japan was the one that really pushed for the rest of the TPP countries to go ahead and come together and finish that agreement, even though the U.S. had pulled out.
Yes.
It strikes me that, again, at the risk of oversimplification, this is obviously about policy, but it's also about personality, whereas the World Trade Organization likes consensus and goodwill. It seems like the president is a fan of confrontation. 20 seconds for each of you as we start to wrap up. If the United States pulls out of the World Trade Organization, how would Americans tangibly feel that difference on the ground? Phil, we'll start with you.
I think what would happen is the U.S. would find that it gets disadvantaged in global trade relative to where we are now. We've crafted a system that works well for American workers and businesses, and we lose those benefits.
Ambassador, you get the last word.
Well, the fundamental thing that may happen is the U.S. may be discriminated against. So all of a sudden, countries can start enacting policies that ban or put higher tariffs on the U.S. and the U.S. alone. In that way, we suffer. And we also suffer because we're not out there opening up new markets for American goods and American agriculture.
Ambassador Jennifer Hillman is a former trade negotiator in the Clinton administration. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Phil Levy is a former economic advisor in the George W. Bush administration. Phil, great to have you as well.
Great to be with you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. I'm Bud Mishkin. This is On Point.